And for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 7th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Peter Zaffino will step down as chief executive of American International Group after a turbulent period that peaked with the insurer insisting that it wasn't for sale. The Dow and S&P 500 rose to records, gaining 0.6% and 1% respectively, while the NASDAQ advanced 0.6%. Hilton took the relatively rare step of removing a hotel from its system amid online criticism over the property's refusal to house ICE officers destined for Minneapolis. Eli Lilly is in advanced talks to acquire Ventyx Biosciences for more than $1 billion, targeting a company that has been developing inflammation inhibitors. An equipment financing company lent money to First Brands at usurious rates as part of a kickback scheme with a top executive, according to the auto parts supplier's creditors. Ford's fourth quarter sales rose from prior year as lower priced truck sales helped it more than offset a decline in electric vehicles. Brewer AB InBev agreed to repurchase a minority stake in its U.S.-based metal container plants for around $3 billion to strengthen its security of supply. Morgan Stanley plans to launch exchange-traded funds holding Bitcoin and Solana, joining traditional bank peers in embracing crypto. Meta Platforms said it would delay rolling out its latest smart glasses model to foreign countries, deferring to high demand from customers in the U.S. A teachers' union in Texas sued the state's education agency over its investigations into educators who criticized conservative activist Charlie Kirk after his death. Representative Doug LaMalfa, who represented the district in Northern California for 13 years, has died, shocking colleagues and further narrowing the GOP's slim majority. Iranian authorities met a large protest in the Tehran Grand Bazaar with a heavy police response as the unrest extended into a second week. China banned the export to Japan of goods with potential military uses, intensifying its retaliation against the country's prime minister for remarks she made about Taiwan. The picture on today's front page shows President Trump standing behind a podium delivering a speech. And that caption reads, "President Trump, addressing GOP lawmakers Tuesday, is openly pursuing a takeover of Greenland after intervening in Venezuela. European governments saw little choice but to speak out on Greenland." The article, "President's Greenland Demand Spreads Alarm Among Allies." European leaders reluctant to criticize U.S. over Venezuela, fear end of NATO. By Marcus Walker in Rome and Matthew Dalton in Paris. President Trump's embrace of military interventionism in Latin America has led to the diplomatic equivalent of embarrassed coughing from the U.S. allies in Europe. But his renewed designs on the Danish territory of Greenland are causing growing alarm. Since the U.S. military raid on Caracas that captured Venezuelan strongman Nicolas Maduro, Trump has threatened to use force elsewhere in the Western Hemisphere and redoubled his demand for a U.S. takeover of Greenland. Denmark has urged the U.S. to stop threatening the territory of a historic ally and warned that any U.S. military operation to seize Greenland would spell the end of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Major European NATO members rallied to Denmark's side, calling on the U.S. to choose cooperation, not coercion, in a statement Tuesday. The past few days have renewed fears in Europe that the Western alliance is fracturing. Trump's growing taste for big stick diplomacy in the Americas is adding to fears among traditional allies that the U.S. is actively dismantling the post-World War II international order based on principles such as protecting the sovereignty of states and limiting the use of military force. In its place, allies fear is a division of the world into great power spheres of influence with the U.S., China, and Russia becoming regional hegemons while curtailing the sovereignty of smaller countries. Faced with that, European governments' instinct has been to try to salvage what is left of the West, including by taking an emollient line on U.S. intervention in Venezuela to avoid angering Trump. In European capitals, the message has been good riddance to Maduro, but that Trump's way of removing him maybe wasn't ideal. President Emmanuel Macron of France initially said Venezuelans could rejoice at Maduro's fall. A spokeswoman later said the president didn't support the method of military intervention. Chancellor Friedrich Merz of Germany and the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer avoided taking a view on whether the US raid on Caracas violated international law. During a closed briefing on Monday, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers that recent administration threats against Greenland didn't signal an imminent invasion and that the goal is to buy the island from Denmark, according to people familiar with the discussions. Rubio's statements come as Trump and senior administration officials have declined to rule out seizing the territory by force. The president and his team are discussing a range of options to pursue this important foreign policy goal, and of course, utilizing the U.S. military is always an option at the commander-in-chief's disposal, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said in a statement on Tuesday. Denmark has said there is no need for the U.S. to take over Greenland to protect U.S. security. The U.S. has a military base on the island and can work with Greenland and Denmark to expand its presence under existing treaties. Denmark has also said Greenland is not for sale. Venezuela regime aims to appease Trump. Acting president alternately strikes defiant tones and conciliatory notes. By Kija Villas. Venezuela's new leader has a narrow path to survival. Appease both the hardline remnants of Nicolas Maduro's regime and President Trump. Delcy Rodriguez's dilemma was illustrated in the hours after Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, were snatched from their bedroom by U.S. commandos on Saturday. Rodriguez, a socialist, hit the airwaves with a defiant tone, denouncing an imperialist attack and declaring that her boss remained the nation's rightful leader. By the next day, Rodriguez appeared on television leading a cabinet meeting as the acting president and seemed to offer an olive branch to Trump, who has threatened stronger actions unless the regime in Caracas submits. We prioritize moving toward balanced and respectful international relations between the United States and Venezuela, Rodriguez said, premised on sovereign equality and non-interference. Rodriguez's tone shift highlighted the balance that her shaky interim leadership is testing out as she tries to withstand U.S. pressure while keeping the country's revolutionary government from dissolving into factional infighting. On the one hand, Rodriguez is hoping to appeal to Trump's transactional tendencies by granting U.S. firms new deals in Venezuela's vast oil fields. In doing so, Rodriguez, once Maduro's top economic advisor, would want to relieve U.S. pressure on the country without having to make deep democratic overhauls. But at the same time, concessions to Washington could threaten stability and the unity among the regime's main power brokers. For hardline leftist and self-proclaimed anti-imperialist figures such as Interior Minister Diosdado Cabello and Defense Minister Vladimir Petrino, who control the nation's police, army, and paramilitary forces, surrender to the U.S. is treason. She's sandwiched between U.S. firepower and Venezuelan firepower, said David Smeld, a professor who tracks Venezuelan politics at Tulane University. She can't kowtow too much. Trump said the U.S. will effectively run Venezuela. That includes maintaining a military encirclement of the Caribbean waters that the country uses to export oil, while coaxing what is left of Maduro's government to hold together and pave the way for U.S. energy companies to return to the South American country, pressing for democratic transition in the country, in the past, a cornerstone of the U.S.'s policy toward Venezuela, appears to have been put on the back burner, political analysts said. Opposition is frozen out of Venezuela. U.S. says Maduro allies will rule, leaving regime's rivals with no governing powers. By Ryan Dubay. Venezuela's opposition woke up with a jolt of euphoria Saturday when it learned that the U.S. forcefully ousted the authoritarian Nicolas Maduro, opening the way for its own leader, Maria Corina Machado, to take power. A few hours later, President Trump threw cold water on the idea, saying Machado didn't have enough respect or support in Venezuela to lead. Instead, he turned to one of Maduro's top lieutenants, Delcy Rodriguez, to lead a transition. I have never seen a speech destroy the image of a movement more quickly than that, said Javier Corrales, an Amherst College scholar who has written books on Venezuela. Venezuela's opposition is facing one of the biggest tests in its quarter-century battle against Chavismo, the far-left movement led by Maduro and named after his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. Not only does the opposition have to vie with a repressive regime at home, but now Machado and her allies also have to contend with a U.S. administration that is focused on securing their nation's vast oil wealth and cementing Washington's control over the Western Hemisphere, rather than holding elections in Venezuela and restoring democracy. Machado captured the world's attention with her daring escape from Venezuela last month to receive a Nobel Peace Prize in Norway. Now, outside her country, she has to find a way to become relevant again. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. L.A. fire recovery a year on is rocky. Many homeowners are still waiting for insurance payouts, building permits. By Jim Carlton, Shane Shiflett, and Rebecca Picciotto, Malibu, California. High above the crashing Pacific, Roxanne White walks the burned grounds of what used to be her family's home. She stops next to a patch of bare dirt where once a long kitchen table had hosted countless Thanksgiving dinners. "I feel we'll never do that again," White, 69, said, choking up as she stared at the remnants of a house lost in the Los Angeles fires last year that her parents built half a century ago. "I mean, not here." What is among the majority of victims still struggling to rebuild after wind-driven fires last January tore through Southern California, killing at least 31 and destroying more than 10,000 single-family homes? The $65 billion in losses are the largest for a wildfire disaster in U.S. history, according to an estimate by insurance broker Gallagher Ray. Most of the homes destroyed in the Eaton and Palisades fires were in three communities: Altadena, a middle-class neighborhood on the city's east side; the Tony Hillside Pacific Palisades; and high-end beachfront Malibu. In the 12 months since, LA's recovery has been slow and uneven. The ability to rebuild in the three areas has been determined as much by residents' wealth and insurance coverage as it has by government officials' willingness to cut red tape. The communities are governed separately: Alameda by Los Angeles County, Pacific Palisades by the City of Los Angeles, and Malibu as a standalone city. The Wall Street Journal looked at more than 9,000 homes destroyed in the three communities hardest hit. Of those, only about one-third have taken permitting or other steps to rebuild, while 4% have sold. An analysis of property records, fire damage, and permitting databases found the rest remain much as they were after the fire debris was cleared. How United Health Killing Changed Corporate Security, by Chip Cutter and Theo Francis. When the CEOs of Delta Airlines, International Business Machines, Target, and others gathered for a confab in New York in December, stepped-up security was apparent before attendees even walked in. A New York Police Department cruiser sat opposite the main entrance. Officers milled about nearby. Executives received instructions telling them to expect elevated security throughout the day. The protocols reflect a new reality in corporate security a year after United Healthcare Chief Executive Brian Thompson was killed on a New York City sidewalk nearby. Some of the business world's most visible CEOs, such as Elon Musk, now travel surrounded by a bevy of bodyguards. Even small companies are bulking up their efforts to safeguard top brass. Yet protecting top executives against security threats remains more challenging than ever, security professionals said. More boards are insisting on tighter security, pointing to resentment of big business and rising violence, including the killings of conservative activist Charlie Kirk and a Democratic Minnesota legislator and her husband, a shooting in New York's Midtown last summer when a former high school football player killed four people at a building housing the offices of the National Football League, Blackstone, and accounting firm KBMG has also spurred action. The threats are absolutely still there, said Brian Stevens, a former chief security officer at the Bank of America, who advises companies about security at Tenio. Ford is struggling to fill six-figure mechanic jobs, by Christopher Otts, Kent, Ohio. Just after 7 a.m. on a recent morning, Ted Hummel leaped up onto the front bumper of a 2019 Ford F-150 and reached under the hood to disconnect a pair of oxygen sensor connectors. It is the first step of dozens to replace the truck's transmission, a job that is expected to take about 10 hours. Hummel is confident that he can do it in half the time. I should have it out of here by lunch, he said. Most mechanics at the Claiborne Ford dealership in Kent, Ohio, hate messing with transmissions. The duffel bag-shaped 300-pound machines that transfer power to the vehicle's wheels. Hummel is one of the few who relish diagnosing their problems, taking them apart, and finagling them in and out of trucks. A soft-spoken 39-year-old father of two, Hummel is one of Ford Motor's highest-status automotive technicians, a senior master. For that, he is rewarded. Hummel said he earned about $160,000 for 2025. There is almost always a transmission for him to work on, and in the unconventional system for mechanics pay, Hummel's efficiency means more money for him and for his dealership. I wish we could clone Ted, said Sean Bradford, Claiborne Ford service manager and Hummel's boss. There aren't enough Teds, not only at Claiborne Ford, but across the country. The automotive industry has faced a shortage of mechanics for decades, and Ford Chief Executive Jim Farley put the issue back in focus in November. Speaking on a podcast, Farley said Ford dealerships have 5,000 open jobs. We are in trouble in our country, Farley said. A bay with a lift and tools and no one to work in it? Farley said the jobs can pay $120,000 a year, but they take 5 years to learn. Only a small sliver of mechanics stick around long enough to get that level of pay. The work is physically grueling. It is costly to start because mechanics need tens of thousands of dollars worth of tools. And the starting pay is closer to fast food wages than to six figures. The 2024 median pay for a dealership mechanic or technician in the U.S. was $58,580, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. When you can't get home and nobody feels sorry for you. Strikes in Venezuela left travelers stranded? Boo-hoo, you're stuck on an island? By Melissa Korn and Allison Pohl. San Juan, Puerto Rico. Cinda Clemens came here to celebrate her 40th birthday and ring in the new year. Now she's just looking for a way home. Clemens, who met in San Juan with friends and family, including two from Ireland and three from Indiana, was supposed to head back to New York on Saturday evening. But that morning, friends scheduled to leave on an earlier flight alerted the group that the airspace above the Caribbean island was closed after U.S. military action in Venezuela. All flights were being canceled. To make matters worse, some of her friends back home aren't too sympathetic. She's getting messages along the lines of, "Boo-hoo, you're stuck on an island," she said. The strikes in Caracas and the arrest of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro have upended the geopolitical order across Latin America. It also created the ultimate first world problem, tens of thousands of travelers stuck in exotic locations. Those who are stranded want everyone to know that while they're not complaining, they're not exactly having fun. Many have spent the past few days in a frenzy of phone calls and web searches for flights. Sure, they may have been poolside in 80-degree weather, but trying to get a live airline agent is hell in any setting. UK, France plan to form military hubs in Ukraine, by Lawrence Norman and Naomi Bisserby. The UK and France will set up military hubs across Ukraine and build protected facilities to produce weapons and military equipment for the country if a ceasefire agreement is reached between Kyiv and Russia, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said on Tuesday. The commitments, which offer some of the clearest details of the security guarantees Western allies will offer Ukraine, come as the U.S. continues its push for an end to the fighting. On Tuesday, leaders and senior officials from Europe, the U.S., and other partners met in Paris to discuss two of the issues at the heart of peace talks: security guarantees to protect Ukraine from a future Russian attack, and a U.S.-led economic package to help Kyiv recover from the war. European leaders and their allies in Canada, Australia, and elsewhere committed to taking part in a U.S.-led monitoring and verification of a ceasefire, as well as long-term commitments to Ukraine's military and legally binding pledges to support Ukraine in the face of a future Russian attack. Iran protests swell in bazaar. Authorities arrest hundreds and disrupt internet as currency falls to new low, by Benoit Falcon. Iranian authorities met a large protest in the Tehran Grand Bazaar on Tuesday with a heavy police response, as the unrest extended into a second week and the currency fell to a new low. Videos posted on social media showed crowds of demonstrators gathering in the capital's central market, the beating heart of Iran's economy. The protesters then rushed out as tear gas spread in the narrow alleyways and a nearby metro station, according to footage verified by Storyful, which is owned by the News Corp, the parent company of the Wall Street Journal. Police also fired tear gas into the grounds of Sina Hospital, roughly 1.7 miles north of the bazaar, according to verified footage. The Fars News Agency, which is affiliated with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, said the gatherings were scattered and posted pictures of people walking by in nearby streets. The protest started in late December among merchants angered by the fast drop of Iran's currency and have since taken a political turn, pulling in students and others who chanted anti-regime slogans. On Tuesday, the protesters chanted against rising prices and denounced Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. Central to Iran's economic problems are tight international sanctions. Tehran and Washington have engaged in talks about Iran's nuclear program that could have led to relief, but Iran's leaders refused to budge on a demand that they stop enriching uranium. Iran's problem worsened in the aftermath of a disastrous war with Israel that followed in June. The currency has lost about 60% of its value against the dollar since the summer, driving inflation to new highs. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, invade Greenland? Why? Trump can gain more access to the island without the bullying. Americans are trying to figure out President Trump's goals in Venezuela, but spare a thought this week for Greenland. The president has good strategic instincts about the world's largest island, so it's regrettable that his interest is devolving into a self-defeating exercise in U.S. bullying. We need Greenland, Mr. Trump said on Air Force One this weekend. It's so strategic. Right now, Greenland is covered with Russian and Chinese ships all over the place. We need Greenland from the standpoint of national security. The U.S. does need to hedge against future Russian and Chinese inroads in the Danish territory. Nearby are vital submarine lanes and the island host U.S. missile defense radars that protect the homeland. Beneath the ice are reserves of rare earth minerals. Liberals booed Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton in 2019 when he suggested buying the island, but he had a point. Yet the operative word was buy. A free agreement among the U.S., our NATO ally Denmark, and Greenland's 56,000 people. This week, presidential advisor Stephen Miller, in one of his familiar beat-the-press showdowns, declined to rule out military force. Nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland. A White House statement Tuesday said Mr. Trump is considering several options, including use of the military. The invasion talk is probably Trumpian bluster to prod a negotiation to buy the island or end up with some other expanded U.S. presence. But even the suggestion of force is damaging America's interest across the Atlantic. Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen was candid that if the United States chooses to attack another NATO country militarily, then everything will come to an end, including NATO. The truth of that statement is what makes military action from Mr. Trump hard to take seriously. But feuding with friends over Greenland is giving Vladimir Putin another wedge to divide America from Europe to his benefit. That means less U.S. leverage for driving a good and durable Ukraine settlement. Nothing precludes Mr. Trump from shoring up America's position on Greenland, including mining to reduce U.S. reliance on China. A bipartisan statement from U.S. lawmakers Tuesday noted that Denmark has accepted every request to increase our military presence on the island. The U.S. could restore its larger military footprint on Greenland from the Cold War and perhaps ensure enduring access, even if Greenland someday changes its political relationship with Denmark. Mr. Trump could also continue leveraging U.S. relationships as a force multiplier in the Arctic. An underappreciated Trump administration achievement is a deal last fall to build 11 icebreakers with Finland. The Danes spent 3.2% of their economy on defense last year, up from 1.15% in 2014, so they can contribute. These alliances are better for U.S. interests than grabbing a new territory and its domestic policies against the will of the locals. Mr. Trump has enough on his hands elsewhere that the Greenland spat may blow over. But Mr. Miller's line in the same interview that the world is governed by power and force is revealing. The left is deploying absurd false equivalences to accuse Mr. Trump in Venezuela of violating international law, which exists only as long as civilized nations exist. Western military power is indispensable. But the corollary is that successful U.S. presidents don't reduce America's role in the world to might makes right. Maybe the Greenland affair is merely what now passes for online mega entertainment. But Mr. Trump would help his own cause in every hemisphere if he dropped the invade Greenland routine. Free Venezuela's political prisoners. Why hasn't Trump told the regime to release the 800 dissidents it holds? President Trump told the world on Saturday that, after deposing Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro, the U.S. will be in charge in Caracas. "We are going to run the country now," he said at a Mar-a-Lago press conference. Yet more than 3 days later, nearly 800 political prisoners remain behind bars in Venezuela's notorious dungeons. Are we supposed to believe this is U.S. policy? Or is the old regime, under the new management of Maduro henchwoman Delcy Rodriguez, still in charge? Locking up dissidents to frighten the population into submission is a staple of the Maduro political machine. Foro Penal, the Venezuelan nonprofit that tracks political prisoners, says there has been 18,618 such detentions in the country since 2014. Venezuela tried to paint a merciful profile on Christmas Day by claiming to release some 99 dissidents. Most had been arrested during protests against the regime's stolen presidential election in July 2024. But Foro Penal also reports that in the week ending December 29th, there were 10 new arrests. At that rate, the dictatorship can refill its cells in a few months. Families of prisoners and some former prisoners report that conditions inside the jails are inhumane. They report beatings, psychological torture, and lack of sunlight, adequate food, and medical care. Foro Penal finds that the majority of those doing time have been denied even the standard sham trial. Only 184 have been convicted. Foro Penal says the whereabouts of another 68 dissidents grabbed by authorities are unknown, which means they may have been killed. Foro Penal political prisoner totals include 176 members of the military. Their detention explains why there has been no uprising in the barracks, despite reports that mid-level officers and enlisted soldiers support the political opposition. Breathe a word of dissent, and military counterintelligence will see that you're put away. This was the reality under Mr. Maduro, who is now in a Brooklyn jail cell. Remind us again, is Mr. Trump running Venezuela or not? There RFK Jr. goes again. His new schedule for childhood vaccines will enrich the trial bar. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. never rests in his quest to make trial attorneys richer. On Monday, the Health and Human Services Secretary unveiled a slimmed-down childhood immunization schedule that could open vaccine makers to a flood of lawsuits and is sure to make children sicker. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is eliminating several vaccines long recommended as routine for children. Vaccines for meningitis, hepatitis A and B, dengue, which is characterized by severe pains in the joints and muscles, flu, COVID, and RSV will now be recommended only for high-risk children or be left to shared clinical decision-making between doctors and parents. After an exhaustive review of the evidence, we are aligning the U.S. childhood vaccine schedule with international consensus while strengthening transparency and informed consent, Mr. Kennedy said. The reasons for the CDC changes are anything but transparent, and they weren't even blessed by the Secretary's hand-picked vaccine advisory panel. Since when has the Trump administration justified a decision based on international consensus? Pandemic lockdowns were also the consensus. In any case, the prior vaccine recommendations dovetailed with those of other developed countries, with the exception of COVID vaccines, which the CDC had recommended for all kids, but most other countries don't. Mr. Kennedy's vaccine model is Denmark, which is an outlier. Its socialized health system recommends fewer vaccines than most countries in the West because some diseases like hepatitis B are less prevalent there. It doesn't want to spend money vaccinating children against bugs they are unlikely to encounter, even if they could be hospitalized if they do. The vaccines that the CDC says children no longer need prevent tens of thousands of hospitalizations each year in the U.S. They also prevent diseases later in life caused by childhood infections. The CDC estimates that the rotavirus vaccine prevents 40,000 to 50,000 pediatric hospitalizations a year. It also limits that stomach bug spread in households and schools. Since the hepatitis B vaccine was universally recommended at birth in the early 1990s, the number of newborns infected with the virus each year has fallen to about 20 from 20,000. Hep B increases risk of cirrhosis and liver cancer later in life. A report teeing up Mr. Kennedy's vaccine changes doesn't deny the benefits of immunizations or cite new risks. Instead, it justifies the revisions on grounds of restoring public trust, which government squandered in the pandemic with vaccine mandates and lockdowns guided more by politics than science. As a result, the report says, there was a decline in childhood vaccination rates across the country, And some states have vaccination rates below the estimated community immunity threshold for both measles and rubella. The public will supposedly trust vaccines more if there are fewer of them. This is illogical, especially as Mr. Kennedy foments to trust in vaccines by claiming the government has concealed side effects to enrich vaccine makers. The report also sows distrust in doctors by suggesting they're forcing vaccines on children to make more money. The secretary has long wanted to overhaul the vaccine schedule to reduce liability protection for manufacturers under the 1986 National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. This no-fault system ensures individuals are compensated by the government in a timely manner for vaccine injuries, though it also makes it harder to pursue class actions. Vaccines must be recommended for routine administration, our emphasis, to children or pregnant women to be covered by the program. Voila! By changing the government's recommendations, Mr. Kennedy is inviting his trial lawyer friends to maraud vaccine makers. Call it the RFK way. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the opinion pages, what Maduro's capture says about Trump. The White House is serious about U.S. preeminence in the Western Hemisphere. By William A. Galston. Although no one knows how events in Venezuela will play out, the seizure of Nicolas Maduro and his wife crystallizes key shifts in U.S. foreign policy that are likely to endure for the rest of President Trump's second term. We can learn at least four things about this administration's approach to international affairs from this event. First, we should take seriously the 2025 National Security Strategy, which the White House published last November. The document states, after years of neglect, the United States will reassert and enforce the Monroe Doctrine to restore American preeminence in the Western Hemisphere. It argues that America's hemispheric preeminence is a condition of our security and prosperity, a condition that allows us to assert ourselves confidently where and when we need to in the region. Our actions in Venezuela provide a clear example of this policy. Second, our Venezuela policy and the administration's justification for it are consistent with America's continuing move away from the global responsibilities of the post-war era toward a spheres of influence approach to foreign policy. The National Security Strategy states bluntly, the days of the United States propping up the entire world order like Atlas are over. The idea is that some regions, chief among them the Western Hemisphere, are more essential to our core national interests than others, and we will concentrate our resources on those areas. This means shifting our military presence away from regions whose relative import to American national security has declined, to address urgent threats in our hemisphere. This shift towards spheres of influence may help explain why the new national security strategy doesn't use forceful language characterizing Russia's invasion of Ukraine as an act of aggression. Instead, it uses non-condemning terms of phrase such as hostilities in Ukraine, and Russia's war in Ukraine. This suggests that Mr. Trump may have some sympathy for Vladimir Putin's claim that his country has a special relationship with its near abroad and is entitled to deference from powers outside this region. This is, after all, the logical extension of the Monroe Doctrine. As this way of thinking gains influence, the risks multiply. Kurt Mills, executive director of the American Conservative magazine, argues in Politico that the U.S. just ceded the high ground to rally world support to defend Taiwan. If such a test comes, we'd better hope that Mr. Mills is wrong. Third, concerns about democracy are subordinate to other considerations in the Trump administration's decision-making. After U.S. forces captured Mr. Maduro and his wife, Mr. Trump said that the U.S. will run Venezuela until a proper transition could take place. Mr. Rubio told NBC that while we all wish to see Venezuela make a transition to democracy, there are some short-term things that have to be addressed right away. On Saturday, Maria Corina Machado, the brave opposition leader who won last year's Nobel Peace Prize, called for Armando Gonzalez Urrutia, the opposition candidate who won the 2024 presidential election, to be installed as Venezuela's commander-in-chief. Mr. Trump casually brushed aside Ms. Machado, saying that she's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect of the Venezuelan people. So far, the Trump administration has chosen to do business with Mr. Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, a hard-line socialist and left-wing anti-Semite who said that the U.S. capture of Mr. Maduro had Zionist undertones. Fourth, the Venezuelan operation continues Mr. Trump's long-standing focus on oil as a source of revenue and power. During the 2016 presidential campaign, he said that seizing Iraq's oil could have paid for the Iraq War. We go in, we spend $3 trillion, we lose thousands and thousands of lives, and then what happens is we get nothing, he said. It used to be to the victor belongs the spoils. The Journal reports that Mr. Trump has made similar remarks about Syria and Libya. Against this backdrop, Mr. Trump's statements after Mr. Maduro's ouster should come as no surprise. We are going to be taking out a tremendous amount of wealth out of the ground, he told reporters. The U.S., he said, will keep some of it in the form of reimbursement for the damages caused us by that country. After seizing Mr. Maduro and his wife, Mr. Trump renewed his demand to acquire Greenland. Pressed by CNN's Jake Tapper on whether this could involve the use of force, Stephen Miller, one of the president's most influential advisors, replied, "There's no need to even think or talk about this in the context that you're asking of a military operation. Nobody's going to fight the United States militarily over the future of Greenland." Similarly troubling was a comment that revealed his outlook on foreign policy. We live in a world, in the real world, Jake, that is governed by strength, that is governed by force, that is governed by power. These are the iron laws of the world since the beginning of time. If Mr. Trump doesn't repudiate these remarks and assure the public that the U.S. doesn't intend to seize Greenland, people around the world will believe that Mr. Miller speaks for the U.S., if they don't already think so. Letter to the editor, Trump's transactional reign. Karl Rove makes a persuasive case that many of the standard measures used to judge a year, economic growth, employment, inflation, crime, don't justify the level of public unease. Yet something else lies at the center of that discontent. Trust erodes when governance appears transactional rather than principled. When pardons, tax policy, and access to power seem tied to loyalty or financial benefit, citizens begin to doubt individual decisions and the fairness of the system itself. No amount of messaging will resolve that. Only honesty and transparency can. From Lori Devlin, Pat Chug, New York. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows a man in the front of a canoe paddling, and in the rear is a dog with an oar between his teeth, held high in the air. The caption, "I thought you were supposed to be good at this." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 7th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful day.